Peter R. Breggin, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour.
Hello, hello. As always, as forever, my wonderful audience, along with wonderful guests, got an especially wonderful one today. Again, I'm so glad to be talking to you. I was wondering about what in particular to share before we get started today. And last night I talked to a few million people on George Norrie's Coast to Coast. And he wanted me to talk about the Toronto van attack. If you haven't heard about it, a young man, 25 years old, drove his car, his van into, drove a van into crowds in Toronto, filled with rage apparently at women and fear of women, killing 10 people. I don't have the breakdown yet. It may be out, but it was said mostly women, and hurting a great many more people. And it turns out he's involved with, in his own mind at least, with a group that is very outraged at women who, for not having relationships, sex, and love with them. They consider themselves to be involuntary bachelors, or involuntary, in his case, a virgin. He apparently never had a relationship with a woman of any kind. And he's described as being terrified of women. And of really avoiding them, living with his father. And he tried to go into the service within the last year or two. He went to boot camp and dropped out. Now, there isn't enough here to talk about in terms of psychiatry. I think that they were hoping I'd have something to say about psychiatric drugs and so on, but we don't have any information, at least didn't last night when I really researched it. I didn't see any before the show today. And, of course, we have that very common pattern of a person who doesn't have friends, is socially withdrawn, driven by shame, shame being certainly the major emotional drive of all violence. Even when it's organized violence, people are reacting to insults and humiliations, whether they are real or whether they're created by propaganda. The shame, the big driver of the violence, he certainly experienced that. But one thing I did raise, which I haven't emphasized enough, is the issue of what is happening to men and boys. What is happening to them? And throughout the country, and North America and Western Europe as well, maybe even more so, you know, men have really been deprived of and are letting go of so much of what men tend to be, which is the hopefulness of being strong, protecting your family, protecting your country, having higher ideals, having strong, virtuous ethics that you adhere to, and all of that almost always went along with a belief in God, some sort of religious concepts, but definitely a belief in God. And a belief in family. And how many of these things I'm rolling off now are undermined by the current society, the breakdown of the family, the breakdown of any kind of set of sound ethics, the breakdown of really the attack on masculinity, on manhood, which certainly has had its extremely abusive elements over the ages. I'm well read in patriarchy and have written extensively about it in some of my books, including way back in Toxic Psychiatry. But the other side of it is the values that have made men who we are, and the struggles we have with violent feelings and the struggle we have with other issues, but nonetheless, which have made us the protectors of society that have made us in many ways who we are. So this is complicated, and I'm not going to come out and, you know, have a solution, but I think we need to start paying attention not only to what has happened to women in our culture and what has happened to many minorities in Western society and throughout the world, and indeed in every culture, what has happened to women, to children, to minorities in the culture, including the U.S. But we need to look at what's happening to boys and men. I really think we need a greater public discussion of that. And I know there are a lot of people out there who have said this, but they've said it quietly. There are a lot of people who are noticing that young men aren't even going to college much anymore, aren't even going to medical, law school, that the numbers of women now, and I'm so glad to see that they're equal, but they're outnumbering young men. So we need to look at what's happening to young men. And I know this won't make everybody happy, but I think it's critically important. My guest today, I won't ask him to comment on my intro, is a man I have profound respect for, Bob Fultz. Robert, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Oh, you sound good. Is that just a cell phone you've been on when we talked earlier? Because it's got a great strength and clarity.
Yeah, I've got earbuds in, though, with the microphone. So hopefully that's the improvement.
Well, that's good. You sound great.
Yeah.
Robert Fultz, I've known Bob for so many years. He has been in practice for 20 years, but I suspect is almost half my age still. I'm not sure. Bob teaches at the, I'm not going to let you answer yet, at the Chicago School of Professional Psychology. He started his career nearly 30 years ago in education, working with inpatients and psychiatric units, working in the VA, and then getting involved with residential treatment centers for severely disturbed youth. We really need to have compassion and know what you're doing. He has been in those settings for 15 years as a clinician and an administrator. He also is doing some really good research, and we'll have him talking about that when he comes on. We'll get more deeply into that. He's also done really good work in psychopharmacology and is giving talks on the hazards of psychiatric drugs. He's a courageous, brave, good human being, and just combines a lot of the best traits I expect from a young man who is now an older man. There's my intro to Robert Fultz. Side D. He's got a Bob is a side D. I don't think he even mentioned it in his write up here. Hi, Bob. It's glad to have you on the show again. You were one of my very first guests when I first set this show up, but many years ago. I think you were my first or second guest.
Wow, great. Well, and thank you for the introduction. And it reminded me of how we first officially met, and this goes back, I think. Oh my gosh, it was right when the first edition of Brain Disabling Treatment and The Heart of Being Helpful came out. And I was a graduate student back then. Was that like 96 or 97?
Well, the first, 98, I think, is when Heart comes out. My God, I got to look it up. I don't have one in reach. But I think Heart came out in 98, but it's a while back. The second edition came out in 2008. So maybe it was 88 that the first edition came out of Brain Disabling.
Because
God, you'd think I'd have it at the tip of my tongue. Go ahead.
Well, I was a
Heart of Being
Healthy,
1997.
Okay,
Brain Disabling,
I was right.
Treatments,
yeah.
First edition, 1997.
Because
that's a while ago.
I had read Toxic Psychiatry in grad school. A professor kind of slid it to me and said, you know, you might want to read this. So I just consumed it and then started to try and get in touch with you. And I got your phone number and started, this is way before email, of course. And you agreed to the next time you were in Chicago, you would, had agreed to come and speak to a group of professors and grad students that were meeting regularly about the non-medication treatment of schizophrenia. So, and the only deal was, because I said, oh, you know, we'd love to have you. And then you told me what your presentation fee was. And I'm like, oh, we got, you know, we're just a bunch of professors and graduate students. And you had said, you know what, if you can get me to the airport after the book conference, I'll come talk to your group. And you came in and talked to us for an afternoon, and it was awesome. I mean, it really, that set my career on a trajectory. So I have a lot to be grateful to you for, starting with toxic psychiatry. But that those were some really formative years for me. So you were doing a book fair. That's why I remember it was on the release of those books. So there was some big, I think at McCormick Place or something here in Chicago, and then you spoke to the group.
Yeah, that's wonderful. That's a nice story. It warms my heart. I'm at the age now where I even more and more appreciate knowing how much I've influenced people and that that's going to go on. I'm in great health, by the way, folks. I plan to go on and on with my new plant-based eating. I'm lost 33 pounds, and I'm out there still. I'm doing everything I've ever done, but it's really good to hear that, Bob. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
You know, can I say tell folks what I wanted to talk about with you? Because I didn't do that in the intro. I kind of got caught up with a little nervousness talking about this kind of volatile subject of what's happening to boys and men. But what I wanted to talk with Bob about, in addition to his work, but it is his work, too, in many ways, is this concept that I'm working on, folks, and we're going to have a course on it, Heart of Being Helpful, in January, working with Pam Popper, the nutritionist, at our conference in November. We're going to kick it off. I want to talk about, you know, what is psychotherapy? It's people talking to each other, and it's people helping themselves and each other, and should it be licensed? And who's going to really be good at it? Does going to college and graduate school help? Or do we just need a really open system, which is where I'm aiming, where I teach people how to talk with other people? And I'm not going to say, but don't talk to somebody who's hallucinating. Don't talk to somebody you think is deluded. I'm going to say the skills for talking with people are universal. And here's how you talk with people about their troubles. And if you apply those same skills to talking to yourself, it's going to work beautifully. And go hang out a shingle that doesn't defend the law in any way. And if you can help people, help people. Something along those lines. And say who's trained you and what you believe in, and let people choose. And if other people want to go to medical school first or get a PhD first, that's up to them. But don't stop us from talking to each other by licensing who can talk to whom about serious issues. Wow. What do you think, Bob?
You know, I think, well, having been teaching now at the graduate level for about almost 10 years, I do have a lot of ongoing thoughts about this very topic. But one of the core pieces of what you're describing is the importance of the relationship. And too often in a training or a particular theoretical or psychotherapy style, too much of it becomes about technique rather than about the relationship. So it even makes me think when I do presentations about medications, one of the things I ask is, what do we believe medications can do that relationships cannot do? And I get a wide range of responses, usually more about the severe stuff, the psychotic symptoms. But the reality is even relationships can help ameliorate psychotic symptoms. So it does. My thoughts are a little different around licensing, in part because I don't always believe people are going to do things responsibly. This, I guess, is my fear. But I think there's a lot of truth to what you're describing there, you know, the importance of having others available to us and having our ability to help others not restricted and not impaired or inhibited just because we don't have a certain credential. But that being said, I think there are some benefits, I would say, about really furthering study about how we organize and explain human behavior and emotions. I think that's the tipping point for me about like why graduate school is valuable, because you really get to immerse yourself and challenge your own beliefs about what makes a difference in somebody's behavior and relationships and so forth.
Well, I think that the Chicago School of Professional Psychology, especially when you're teaching, is going to let students immerse themselves in alternatives and viewpoints and so on. But Bob, that's not the purpose of most psychology schools. I mean, isn't it to set up a good hard trade union that pushes what you have and excludes other people and doesn't leave you open to thinking about Peter Bregan's toxic psychiatry, which says that untrained volunteers were getting people out of mental hospitals in 1954 better than now?
It does raise
challenging today.
Yeah, you know, it does raise, and this is true across all the different disciplines, right? Like the accrediting bodies all have their standards of the way the education should go. And my understanding, like with medical schools, is a lot of those standards are driven by, you know, powerful organizations like the pharmaceutical companies, but. Regarding psychology, the American Psychological Association is the organization that establishes all those standards. And they do have, in fact, my school, we just were accredited again and received the 7-year accreditation, which is the longest, which means we're doing everything we should be doing. We're doing it right. But it does set a core curriculum and determines what we have to spend a certain amount of credits instructing our students on. And some of those are what I would say, well, I would say they're all valuable, but, you know, of course, I would prefer to emphasize different things with my own interests and so forth. But, yeah, you're right. The accrediting organizations have a lot of influence in the messages that that we teach, or at least the overarching curriculum that we establish.
I think that's a really good point. Folks,
really
I'm going to be taking notes on this conversation because this is very near to my heart about the Duke course and what I've been thinking lately and what contributions I want to make now about helping people just learn to help each other outside the system. And Bob is bringing up interesting points. I tell you, this issue of responsibility, I mean, are professionals more responsible than other people? I mean, they're supposed to be. That's the idea of professionalism. If you're a professional, you're supposed to put the other person's interests in the context of the helping relationship ahead of your own. You're not supposed to take advantage in any way at all. That's professionalism. And yet, look, psychiatry is the most abusive profession in the country almost, and it's got the more degrees than anybody, you know, other than surgeons who often aren't doing the right thing either. So I really wonder about responsibility coming from these long educational programs. Does it actually pen people into their own self-interest so much after all of that training? For example, with nutrition, I mean, what cardiologist, what cardiac surgeon wants to learn or study the research indicating that heart disease, including, you know, severe atherosclerosis of the cardiac vessels can be prevented from growing and even reversed with diet? They can't do it after all the training. What are they going to do, become dieticians?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it would be good if the training programs worked that way. I'm just not sure that they actually do. They give a veneer of respectability. I'm not sure they make people more responsible. I don't know. But what about it? What do you think?
I think maybe your school does. Well, it makes me reflect back on my own training, you know. So when I was going through grad school and the fact that I had been reading Toxic Psychiatry, I was already kind of stirring the pot back then. But a lot of what my education was, and I was, even before grad school, I was working in inpatient units because I was just something was just compelling about the condition of schizophrenia, and I wanted to really explore that and understand it. But in my graduate training, I was routinely told that it's a brain disorder, it's a chemical imbalance, it's a genetic condition, and I was also it was emphasized to me that in order to do effective treatment with them or effective psychotherapy, that they had to be effectively medicated first. And there is that study doesn't exist, because when I was doing my dissertation, I was looking for that study because I had heard it so often. I was like, well, it must be out there because everyone's telling me about it. And it just doesn't exist. And then I met people like you and Bert Karen and all the people out there doing really great work, not emphasizing that. But that the point being, the lessons I was getting back then were not accurate, at least in respect to those topics. So it does raise a question, although now here's the flip side as I think this through. In licensing, you know, at least I'm required to maintain a certain ongoing continuing education process, which assumes that I'm updating my education all the time. But that being said, you know, I get to pick and choose what I'm studying. So like you're saying, the importance of nutrition, there is stuff out there for psychologists on that, but not a lot. And what we're learning now with the microbiome is that our gut has a tremendous influence on our thoughts and behaviors and emotions. So it's a complicated issue that you're bringing up.
Well, that's right. I mean, I had to learn about nutrition by being invited to a conference that Pam was holding. She'd heard about me, and then I went to another one, and then I tried it, and then I got well in four or five spheres of what were supposed to be just age-related issues, got better. Blood pressure's normal. Weight is best it's been in 30 years. I mean, and on and on. Yeah, I mean, I get my continuing education outside the educational system, and of course, continuing education has been mostly taken over by the drug companies in the medical sphere, psychiatric medical CMEs for physicians. That's mostly drug company.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, and very little about a more holistic approach like you're describing, you know, integrating nutrition and in so many ways just back to the basics, eating well, exercising, and getting enough sleep. You know, we drill down on the nuance of specific details, and those studies are funded with multi-million-dollar grants and everything else. But, you know, what it's created is everyone's operating in their own silos of specialty. And which makes integrating all this important information really challenging.
Yes, that's a beautiful line. Everyone in their own silos. And we've been watching this happen for decades. And a lot of it is because it's all applied science now, which means it's all business science. Mm-hmm. And it's all in separate spheres so you can go out and make money.
Yeah. Well, and this raises, so it brings right back to the curriculum. One of the big challenges, especially in psychology programs, is the emphasis on evidence-based strategies. And the field is even kind of changing into like a health psychology model that in some ways mimics like a medical model. But you know, the expectation is that psychologists are using evidence-based standards, which makes sense on the surface. But in these different areas that I've been involved with for many years, like residential treatment, for example, the kids that end up in residential treatment are not typically subjects in studies. They come with very complex situations and very complex histories and multiple trauma exposures. Those are not the kids that are informing the evidence base. So right away, mm-hmm. right out of the box, clinicians, maybe if they're working with a challenging population or a challenging client, they may not have a good evidence base. And even the evidence-based studies, this is a little bit of a generalization, but even the best studies out there, the best responses are about 60% of people. And the big difference between responding to treatment, like a treatment response versus a statistical response. those are very different outcomes. So you can achieve statistical significance, which looks great in a study, but many times people are still very symptomatic, even though they may show like they've had a response to treatment. So when you drill down on these details, it does open up Pandora's box. We've got a lot of challenges in front of us.
Let's focus some on the actual helping of people, because that's harder to focus on. And I think we've had a really good discussion about some of these complicated issues. But let me go back to something you said earlier about, you know, that even with psychotic people, talk therapy can help. My experience is, it's the same as Bert Karens, whom we both know and love, you know, with his book on the psychotherapy of schizophrenia, which he considered to be the best approach and the first approach. And my experience is that I have much more success talking with patients who are deeply disturbed than I ever had or saw in my training with people being drugged. And in my training, even I was, any chance I could get, I was not using medications and resisting patients going getting electroshocked and trying very hard to keep them out of the off the attention of the administrators of the ward and so on. I mean, the results of talking honestly and caringly and sincerely and with engagement with somebody who's had several hospitalizations, has recently come out and has still got hallucinations and delusional, paranoid kinds of fears, and how grateful that human being is for the first 10 minutes of being with somebody who promises never to lock them up and never to drug them and to help them come off their meds if they want. And you see the change in 10 or 15 minutes of the person being less bombarded with craziness. I don't know if you've had those experiences, but they're pretty routine. They're pretty routine in my experience.
I definitely have, you know, and it reminds me of a great quote that has stayed with me from Bert Karen. And one thing, I think I was in a course with him, and one thing that he shared was that he tells people that he's meeting for therapy that all he has to offer is understanding, but that's usually enough. And it's exactly what you're saying, you know, that you've got a compassionate approach. You're looking to understand what their experience is. And it's not all muddled by what the expectation of like restricting them and, you know, suppressing these symptoms. One of the things I always bring up is, are we trying to control symptoms or treat the condition? Because a lot of our strategies are about control and not treatment. And as soon as you focus on control, the relationship is out the window because you're thinking in a very different lens.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's absolutely true. And
Well, to your point, I've had many, you know, over the 20 years of being in private practice, I've had many different people that have come in with very severe symptoms, typically on multiple medications, and over time through just patience and just careful exploration of what their experiences have been, they end up either coming off their medications or being on much less medication. And one of the measures that I use in terms of outcomes is how satisfying are their relationships. I think that is the barometer. Even if somebody decides that they want to remain on medications, an outcome of having much more satisfying relationships is really one of the end goals. Because if people are surrounded by healthy relationships, typically things are going to go well for them. I'm working with a young woman right now who was going through a difficult depression. She ended up on medications and in the hospital and really in pretty challenging straits. The medications made her manic, which meant she ended up on much more medication. But that was about 2 years ago, and she's been off her medications now for many months and doing great. And, you know, she was being told over and over and over that she's got this bipolar condition. She had some psychotic symptoms, but she's doing great now. and having very satisfying relationships.
Folks, this happens all the time with therapists who care about their patients and who have the courage and ethics to hang in there with patience and caring and understanding and working with people. Very much so.
You know, and it also makes me think, and kind of on the issue of training and how to create these opportunities for people, there have been some meta-analyses, some studies about psychotherapy determining what works and what doesn't work. The surprising thing is that as much time, and this is true for me, I spent many years studying theory, the therapeutic techniques only account for about 15% of a psychotherapy outcome. They actually, it's the same amount for the expectation, kind of the placebo effect in therapy. So if you are meeting with someone and you expect to get better, you expect that that service is going to be helpful, you've got a 15, that's going to influence the outcome by 15%. So the other common factors that you're describing about the important stuff that happens just within a relationship is about creating a confiding relationship in a healing environment, a place that feels safe, and then offering some sort of assistance in understanding what their experience is. And those are considered to be the common factors. And you're right, it doesn't take a PhD to do it.
It doesn't take a PhD. So what does it take, Dr. Fultz? What does it take?
Oh, that is the million-dollar question. Well, you know, I do think it kind of goes back to what I mentioned. I think that the better we understand and the better we can organize our beliefs around what motivates behavior and relationships and emotions, it helps us create kind of an organizing structure for somebody in that may be confused about those things. Now, it's true, I've had clients over the years that my style just doesn't fit with. It doesn't mean I was wrong. It meant it was a bad fit, and it didn't make sense to them. So the challenge is then creating an explanation or a way to understand their experience that also resonates with their values, kind of what you were talking about at the beginning. Being able to, if they're focused on their family, if they're focused on relationships or success or whatever the barometers are for them to feel more effective in their lives, to offer them an organizing structure to help achieve those things, despite certain challenges that they may be facing. But that is a million-dollar question. I think part of that can come through training, but I think, you know, I hate to say it, I think there are some people that are just naturally great at it that don't need a ton of training. They're just naturally gifted and compassionate and great listeners and help people understand things.
I do think that that what you said earlier is really the key. And of course, the research shows that relationship, whatever you call it, you would know so much more about this than I do. Maybe you could take a minute, talk about how the literature confirms that the starting point is relationship. And then I want to go back to your very interesting comments on organizing structure of how to think about lives and resonating with people's values. But the research, doesn't it in many different ways show that it's the relationship that heals? And is it any different for people who are very disturbed or just, quote, problems in living?
No. In fact, so there are several sources that immediately makes me think of. One is a book called The Great Psychotherapy Debate by a psychologist named Bruce Wampold. He was out of University of Wisconsin-Madison. But one of the things that's highlighted in – so he helped conduct just tons of meta-analytic reviews of psychotherapy. But one of the key pieces in highlighting about the relationship is that the rapport – is either established or not in the very first moments of meeting with a therapist. Now, the reason that matters is because if it isn't a good fit, and I tell my clients when I start working with someone, after our first meeting, I always say, you know what, I want you guys to think about this. and we can schedule our next appointment, but if you cancel, it's okay. If it doesn't feel like it's going to be a place that you can feel safe and open and honest, then I don't want to waste your time. And part of that is because that goodness of fit makes a tremendous difference in how effective those services are going to be. So the relationship is either actually, here's another example. I had a client, and this is years and years ago. I happened to have some music playing in my office when a client came in, and it was, I think it was Coffee House Station from Sirius XM, which is kind of this acoustic music, kind of soft, easy listening kind of music. And she said that within a few minutes, and when she realized, because I had forgotten to turn the music off when she came in, she said that made the difference. I felt comfortable right away, and it just felt like a good fit. So those things happen very quickly. And then the relationship can be, you know, more trust is established and the rapport strengthens, and that bond or that ability to feel open and honest just strengthens over time. And it's also true for very troubled individuals, people that are facing major challenges. Some research that came out years ago with people with a diagnosis of schizophrenia, they rated their experiences in psychotherapy very highly. Like, I think the report was like 70% of them had very positive things to say about psychotherapy because it was helpful. And that was back at a time when people were not even really being trained in how to treat schizophrenia through psychotherapy. This was back when I was in graduate school. And the other thing that makes me think, you know, trauma has been such a major issue these days. Thankfully, you know, the field is becoming much more aware of it and being more aggressive in trying to treat it. But there's a psychiatrist named Bruce Perry that has done a lot of writing and a lot of presentations.
Yes, he's been on the show. I just replayed him the other day.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
He's great. He's got a presentation that's online that speaks to, over time, through ongoing trauma exposure, your reactivity becomes heightened, and eventually you're just your baseline of functioning is a very heightened, kind of dialed up reaction. But what he's also been able to show that over time, through very kind of gradual exposure to challenging emotions and to getting upset, but doing it in a very controlled way of this gentle exposure to those feelings, helps bring that baseline back down. So through relationships, you can undo the damage that has been done with a lot of trauma exposure. And what we also know is that people with a diagnosis of those more severe conditions typically have had pretty significant trauma exposures. So it's just reversing that process through a very thoughtful relationship.
I'm so glad you mentioned relationship with trauma therapy, because one of the things I noticed in some of the literature I read probably years ago was they talked all about re-exposure, and there was no emphasis on them being re-exposed by a caring human being who's keeping them company.
Right. You know, and that goes to the challenge of just mastering a technique rather than mastering the relationship. And that I have seen students fall into that they just want to know what they have to do in therapy. And they lose sight of how valuable they as a tool are. You know, their ability to relate to someone else makes all the difference.
Absolutely. And I really have no doubt about the relationship is that the caring, promoting, advocating relationship is key. And I promote the people who come to see me. If I'm doing a good job, I'm promoting them. I don't know how you think about that. I think, you know, some people who trained me would have thought it was counter-transference. I was involved with the patient in some way. But I promote, I advocate for, I coach.
Yep.
I bet you do that, Bob.
Yeah, I sure do. I think, you know, in my practice over the years, I've always been inclined or partial to work with people that are really struggling. So, I would assume that they often feel like no one is in their corner. So a lot of the work includes working with their families, kind of restructuring or reconfiguring the way people are communicating with each other. And you know what? One of the things in all the years I was working in residential treatment with really troubled youth was giving a voice to their experience. That led to a big research project I did called the Adolescent Subjective Experience of Treatment, when all we did was go to a bunch of different residential treatment centers and interview the teenagers about what they thought worked and didn't work in treatment. And a lot of it came back to relationships. Historically, the kids aren't typically asked what they think about what works and doesn't work. You know, the experts tell them what treatment is going to look like rather than really making it collaborative. There are trends of that changing now, but years ago, it was just the adults telling the kids again what they should be doing or what they shouldn't be doing. So in doing the research, all of these interpersonal variables really rose to the surface as being the most important. And the people that seemed to make the biggest difference for those kids were the ones they spent the most time with. So, you know, I'm trained as a psychologist, but the direct care workers in a residential treatment environment have a profound effect on these kids. And sometimes they're the least trained, but they are all about the relationships. You know, it's called The Other 23 Hours. There's a book from years ago, Larry Brentrow and a couple other authors wrote a book talking about those direct contact hours, because in that kind of milieu, those relationships have a much more substantial impact than the 1 hour of psychotherapy. So, the relationship, it comes back to that over and over.
Yeah, I think it does come back to that over and over again. It's just got me thinking and trying to figure out how to express this to people, how people can see this. Even if you're working with in a nursing home, you see somebody who's especially recently arrived, maybe in the last month or two, and they seem clearly to have dementia. They're disoriented. They're confused. They're anxious. You tell them something, they don't remember it 10 minutes later. Well, if you start to relate to that person, and then maybe you get in touch with a family member who cares about them but who needs some encouragement, and you start working together, you may find that what you were certain was dementia and what is being diagnosed as dementia clears up majorly, because it's really about a person who is elderly and vulnerable, is facing in their own minds the end of their lives, unloved, loss of autonomy in the nursing home, feeling like there's like life is awful, barely able to control all those feelings, putting up a kind face if they can. And all of that is so draining of them that they can't maintain all their cognitive functions. And then you give them life again and relationship again, and they may clear up so you don't even see signs of cognitive dysfunction. So that's a fact from my experience again. Now, it doesn't mean there isn't such a thing as dementia, but I'm talking about what may be happening even more than we realize it to people that we're saying have biological dementia. They don't, because what's happened to them is the severe loss of relationship in their older years.
Well, and even, in the older years, when you start losing your friends and people that you've known for decades and lose a spouse, that just must be so disorganizing. You know, it changes the very structure of your life. Everything that you've relied on for years for your social activities, for the lifestyle of who you call during the day, all of that kind of stuff. When you start losing that, and then probably face some age-related memory loss, you know, that must just be so disorganizing. And it makes me think.
And frightening. It's terrifying.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Terrifying. Right. And there's a program I just heard of in the in England, United Kingdom. They've got a program now for people that are elderly, and very often living alone, but possibly facing ending up in a nursing home, they've got a service now where they are getting visits and phone calls with people that they can spend time just relating to, and it's preserving their ability to live more independently. I just read this, probably 3 months ago, that it's a new social service type of system that they've been able to deliver this service, and it's allowing older people to keep their independence a bit, but it's being done through relationships. It's just some visits and phone calls.
It's so key.
Yeah.
Well, you know, Ginger's mom, who everybody who listens to this show knows, has now been living with us for several months. We've moved into a new home, which we were planning to do anyway, and I felt guilty that it was too big, and then we found that mom needed to move here. I've loved her mom since I met her 35 years ago, and we've been very close. And her mom, through her church and through work with the Isaac Walton League, which is an environmental group, a very old and established environmental group, and through other charitable activities, even though she is in her early 90s, 91, she spent her time just traveling and going places to help people and be with them and take care of them. And she's outlived many of them. And now that she's living here, she's on the phone, not getting help from people, helping people. And sometimes I listen to what I call her practice. And she's giving people things you were talking about. She's giving people a structure to think about. She reminds them of what matters to them. She encourages them to do things that are positive for them that they want to do. And she then tells them to call back in a day or two, or she'll call them and let's see what, if they've done that and called their kid back or whatever that she's suggested they do. So this is just a fact of life. And one of the things that I'm seeing, well, I've seen for a long time, but now I'm beginning to work with, and I'll be telling you more and more about that, with churches. And that's what churches in America have done forever, is provided that kind of close relating community service, people stopping in and helping each other. And certainly the decline of organized religion is another one of the things that's happened here that is depriving people of social relationship, something we professionals, most of us who don't participate in organized religion, and I do not, that we don't realize the huge role it plays in supporting people through relationships. There's many, many ways of people finding relationship and being healed and continually healed by it. And just like in psychotherapy, who knows how much of the healing is the religion itself, the ideas and concepts of the religion, or the faith in God, or the community of the church itself. It certainly all goes together, and it relates again to your idea that therapy provides people an organized way of thinking about their lives. At least good therapy, I think, does do that.
Yep. And highlights the values that help kind of, they're the guideposts or the guardrails as they're negotiating the different challenges in life. Yep. Absolutely.
So I want to go back to the challenge that I'm considering, and I'm actually working on. This radio show is a part of what I'm planning on doing. And that is, you know, I'm going to be teaching a course in January, and it's going to be available online, and it's going to be called The Heart of Being Helpful. And it's basically going to teach people, whether they're in a monopolistic profession or whether they're just people on their own, how to help other people. And I'm not going to be saying, don't you dare talk to somebody who's hallucinating. I'm going to talk to folks about how do you talk to your mother, your father, your brother, your sister, or someone else about their hallucinations, about their ideas that seem strange to you, about their deep depression. How do you help folks with a conversation? And if you're a psychiatrist, I hope you'll take the course, because you probably have never heard about all of this. And if you're a mother, take the course. If you're a friend, take the course. And let's get rid of this idea that only professionals trained in universities in a very secular manner, to boot, can, a materialistic manner usually, can help people with profound problems. No, people help people. This is the theme that I want to be developing, Bob, and trying to share with people in the best way I can.
Yeah, and you know, it makes me think. I don't know if you ever met a guy, a psychologist named Gary Prouty. He was in the Chicago area. He created a therapy approach called pre-therapy, and it was kind of the work that needs to be done before like a formal psychotherapy experience could begin. But it was designed for severely disturbed individuals. And it created reality contact is what he described it as. And he was in the Chicago area, so I got to work with him for years. And actually, Bert Caron put me in touch with him. But his approach was so popular in Europe, and it didn't get a lot of exposure here in the United States. But it makes me think of that community in Europe. Is it Giel? Am I remembering that correctly, where it's a community that embraces everyone that has behavioral and emotional challenges, and it allows
There's a few of them. One's this farming community in one of the Scandinavian countries, maybe Holland, Denmark.
Okay.
And it's in a film. There's actually some films out there. Oh, gosh, I'm going to block on his name. He's a young man who's made all his films free and available. Wonderful young man. I'm blocking on his name. He's traveling around Europe, last I heard, just filming alternatives.
Wow.
To help people.
And it emphasizes what you're describing.
Go ahead.
It is a community approach to relating and caring about people. And it's something, I agree, I think it's something that our society it's slowly just eroded away. We've become very individualized and kind of keep our head in the sand when distress could be occurring to someone else. And, you know, I think part of when thinking about the course that you're developing, I'm reminded again of Bert Caron. And he said one of the most, like, if somebody's coming into you and they're completely disturbed and hallucinating and everything else, one of the most valuable things you can do is not run out of the room. Even though those types of behaviors may be unsettling to you, it's about conveying that sense to them that we can handle this. We can work through this together. And that's a powerful message. And it's just being available to someone.
You know, I actually use those words when I talk to folks. We can handle this.
Yep.
And I might say the same thing to my wife, Ginger, and she might say the same thing to me, and Mom might say that to me or Ginger.
Yep.
We can handle this. It means so much to people to just have somebody they love and respect say something like, we can handle this. And you
yep.
can handle this, but not alone. That's the importance of the we. The
yep.
we can handle this. It's so important.
Yeah.
These are all good lessons, and they're things I want to be teaching folks more and more. Because people really can help people. People are the answer. There's just no question about it.
Yep.
Now, what do I do about all of my wonderful insights? It's always been that big issue for me. I've mentioned on occasion that when I was doing therapy the first 4 or 5 years, I asked some of my clients who were doing the best, and I even called some and asked them if they'd come in for obviously a free hour. I probably should have paid them to come in and tell me what they got out of the therapy and how it was still helping them. And what seemed to sum it up was not, oh, that great information about Mom and what she did, or not learning more about what happened to me in childhood, and not even learning better principles. It seemed to be summed up in the idea that I cared about them so much they started to care about themselves.
You cared
about me so much, Peter, I started to care about myself.
Yeah, you know, there is a book by Irvin Yalom. It's called The Gift of Therapy. And one of the things he's been around forever. He's an expert in the field. But he did kind of this informal survey of his clients. And he asked them what seemed to make the biggest difference in their sessions. And he kept his own notes, too, about what he thought was most effective. And he put a lot of emphasis on being able to kind of crystallize this great interpretation and just synthesize what they're talking about together to make one powerful, you know, kind of summary statement. And he thought those were the most valuable things. What his clients reported to him was they found it most valuable when he said to them, oh, I was thinking about you this week, and then would start the conversation, or I was looking forward to seeing you today. Those types of comments made the biggest differences for his clients. And it's about the relationship again. It's about, I care about you, I enjoy my time with you, and I was looking forward to talking with you. And he's, he's been around.
The wonderful thing is, it's really true. We can do that. We can really care about the folks that come to see us. My God, we've got 2 minutes left.
Oh, okay.
This was fast. It's so important. I mean, all this is so, so important. And I think maybe the organizational system gives us a lot of security. And maybe it gives our clients some security. I still believe that it's just got to be helpful when I notice that a young man is relating to his girlfriend just like he related to his mother, and he's getting the same kind of abuse he got from his mother. I still think that's valuable and liberating.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not what people often feel is helping them the most. So, folks, the most is to be a kind, loving, caring human being and keep it within the limits, because that, I think, is key. We're all too vulnerable. We're too fragile to have loving relationships like that and not put serious limits, professional limits. There's the professionalism, Bob. The professionalism is about always remembering you're there for the client and they're not there for you.
Yeah.
I think that's one of the hearts of professionalism, although it turns out to be a blessing because of the relationships we build. Do you have something? Please say something wonderful as we conclude for the day. Robert Fultz, I haven't even mentioned your name. I've been so into it. F-O-L-T-Z, Bob Fultz. What do you have to say?
Speaking of the relationship, I mean, it was just dawning on me how many we've known each other since 1997. So that's pretty impressive. That's 20 years, 21 years in and of itself. And it's because we established a relationship. We grew from each other. We got to know each other. We learned from each other. It's, you know, it comes back again to the relationship. Very valuable.
Yeah, and I can tell you folks that when I ran into some severe conflict with an organization back in the early 2000s, Bob Fultz was a real friend to me then, and it made such a difference, Bob, such a difference. Yes, it's about relationship. Thank you, wonderful audience. Good relating to you, even if I can't see you.